good life and service this morning. Everybody, there's a lot of red out there too, which is kind of nice. I feel sort of dull. I'll try to do something about that over the next few weeks. Those of you who have heard the story, maybe more times than you need to at this point, of my journey to the Unitarian Universalist ministry, you know that one of the crucial early stops along the way was at the First Unitarian Society in Madison, Wisconsin. And a beautiful building there was designed by Frank Lloyd Wright, and he was a member of their congregation some 50, 60 years ago. It was the minister there nearly 30 years ago who took me under his wing once I left the American Baptist ministry and pointed me in the direction of the UUs. Well, that minister is long since retired, and the current minister of that Madison congregation is a fellow named Reverend Michael Schuler. Michael began his ministry with the Madison congregation at the very same time that I came here, which means that he and I are pretty close to the top, not all the way to the top, but he and I are pretty close to the top when it comes among our colleagues, when it comes to long-standing and still ongoing ministries with a single congregation. I hope he's having as much fun out there as I am here. Well, I'm going to borrow some of Reverend Schuler's remarks from a sermon he gave several years ago to his congregation in Madison as the Christmas and holiday season approached. The title of his sermon was From Atheism to Appreciation. And in this sermon, Michael begins by recounting how in this very strongly humanistic and atheistic household of which he was raised, Christmas, in a matter of speaking, was observed in this manner. There was a good deal of routine joking and logic chopping about God at the Schuler house, but the defining moment in our religious lives arrived each year on Christmas Eve, because that was the time when we sat down in the living room, turned on the hi-fi system, and instead of queuing up a medley of Christmas carols, we instead laughed at the antics of Vladimir and Estragon as they patiently waited for Godot. The paternal God figure who never appears in Samuel Beckett's famous play. Reverend Schuler continues, "This was not a convention that I, as a 12-year-old child, resented. On the contrary, listening to Waiting for Godot at Christmas made me feel superior to those delighted youngsters who still believed in a cosmic charity." I gotta imagine that must have been a pretty strange scene. Kind of got the neighborhood that they're in, decorated with all the stuff we've been putting up over the last few days here. And this family sits around on Christmas Eve and listens to a recording of Samuel Beckett's Waiting for Godot. At the same time, there's a part of me anyway, that kind of connects with that. For Beckett's play was written in that existentialist theater of the absurd genre. It first began being staged in the early 1950s. In some ways, it anticipated John Lennon's well-known line that life is what happens while you're making other plans. Some of you I know are familiar with it. Just to give you the quick overview of it, it features these two hobo-like characters called Vladimir and Estragon, and they're sitting beside a road, figuring they can't go anywhere or do anything until the arrival, or the advent, if you will, of this mysterious Godot, who's supposed to show up and show them the way and give them a reason for moving along. Now, as the play moves along, a few other characters show up, and they claim to have had some knowledge with or some relationship with this Godot or seen him somewhere or other, but that's about as far as it gets. And each of the play's two acts ends with the same bit of dialogue, with the different characters reversing it for each act. Just simply, "Well, shall we go? Yes. Let's go." But the final stage direction at the close of each act is the same. They do not move. They keep waiting for Godot to arrive, to show them the way, and the anticipated arrival or advent never happens. Whatever life there is to be had on the road of life that they're sitting beside just goes along as the two of them wait there. I've only seen this play a couple of times, but if it's done properly, it's quite powerful. And that's a really rather powerful image, because the humanist in me knows that it is futile to wait. for what Schuller aptly calls an imaginary cosmic sugar daddy, who will take us by the hand and show us the way that will make our journeys meaningful and fulfilling. Yes, indeed, for better or for worse, it is we human beings who are responsible for where we go, because there's no one to know who's going to show and do it for us. Well, as a sidebar here, and in the interest of fairness, I should point out that the playwright, Samuel Beckett, insisted that he did not intend his non-existent character of Godot to be a metaphor for God. In his rather crankish Irish way, he noted, "If I wanted Godot to be God, I'd have called my play Waiting for God." That's what he said. Now, Beckett, I believe, meant for his play to be a statement about the futility of living by hope and anticipation alone, of allowing life to pass you by while you're making other plans, or while you're anticipating someone or something beyond yourself to appear and give you some kind of deliverance. But the playwright's protestations have still not stopped this God-Godot equation from being made, which in some ways is fair. And I think whenever a writer or a poet or an artist creates something and puts it out in the public domain, it's kind of fair game for whatever kinds of interpretations or meanings that people want to ascribe to it. And so I think it's a legitimate one, this Godot God business, whether the playwright intended it or not. It is, as we have seen, the interpretation given in the household that Reverend Schuller describes. And this, in fact, gets me back to the rest of Michael's story and to his punchline. After recounting the anti-Christmas family observances of his youth, he goes on to say, "Nevertheless, it doesn't surprise me that as an adult, my older brother gave his life to Christ and is now active in an Assembly of God congregation. Perhaps it isn't always wise to begin the process of demythologizing too early." Close quote. Wise words indeed. For we do not, most of us anyway, we do not live by negation and by pure rationality alone. We need a place for myth and mystery in our lives. And I'm convinced that if we do not in some way nurture myth and mystery in the lives of our children, all the wonderful ones we had here this morning, that we do in fact create, or we do create a kind of a spiritual vacuum that they will at some point and in some way seek to fulfill. They may not do it in the same way that Reverend Schuller's older brother did, but in some way or other, that will probably happen. Well then, picking up on his own religious journey that eventually brought him into the Unitarian Universalist ministry, I said, that's going to make some interesting family gatherings. One brother who's in the Assembly of God, and the other one who's a union minister. What do they talk about? Family reunions, anyway. But it must make for a pretty interesting gathering. And Michael Schuller says, "I am grateful to be in a religious movement where belief in God is an option but not an expectation. A movement where I can be a skeptic one day and a devotee the next. I fervently hope there will always be a place in our movement, not only for the atheist and the theist, but for those of us who cannot accept theist and atheist as mutually exclusive categories." Now, I don't know Michael real well. We've had a few, hi, how are you doing kinds of meetings at some general assemblies now and then. But when I read those words, I feel a connection with him. I feel kind of a kinship with him. "For I, too, find myself being a skeptic one day and a devotee the next," as he puts it. "I, too, am among those who do not accept the idea that both atheist and theist have to be mutually exclusive categories. In fact, I discovered more recently, if you ask me if I believe in God, my answer most likely will have more to do with what kind of a day I'm having, or the kinds of experiences that are being visited upon me, than they do with any sort of theological constructs I may have erected for myself." This stance thing of being both a skeptic and a devotee is the one that I find I do through the Christmas and winter holiday season and all of its many manifestations, including the coming of the Christian Advent, which in the Christian faith tradition it means awaiting birth of a Savior, a Deliverer, a Christ. In a more generalized sense, Advent with a small I means awaiting any significant or momentous event that you hope will in some way transform your life. And so I come into this season finding myself between two contrasting stories, two contrasting myths, two contrasting metaphors, and finding truth in each one of them as well as in the interplay between the two of them. The first story is the one I've already been dwelling on. The story of the God or the meaning or the purpose or the reason for living, call it whatever you will, who never shows up. And the other is the countervailing story, that of a God who really does arrive. Both stories, as I just said, are myths. Myths in the best a la Joseph Campbell sense of the term. That is to say, stories that tell us truths about who we are and about the world that we live in, even if they didn't, quote unquote, really happen. So this second story then, you're all familiar with it, it'll be told numerous times over the next few weeks, is the story of a God or a divine presence that becomes humanized in the person of a human being given the very common name in his day of Jesus, and who comes heralding an era, the arrival of an era of hope and peace, love and justice. And for me, each story is equally captivating. It's kind of funny trying to come to terms with both of them. I sometimes kind of feel like, well, an unfaithful lover sort of embracing one story while I'm looking over my shoulder at the, looking over the shoulder at the other one there, which I will in turn then embrace. Actually, I've never been a... an unfaithful lover, you understand? I'm just using that as an example. Because I happen to think that there is some truth to be found in two-timing a couple of metaphors. It's all symbolic here. Well, let's move on. So I can embrace Beckett's story that he tells in his play while also needing to look beyond it. While the accounts, as noted, are largely mythological about the birth of Jesus, and those accounts are not really central to my journey at this point, they still do offer me some traveling companionship. For in the story of the God who actually does arrive, I do not see the advent of that cosmic sugar daddy who will fix everything for us, but instead, some very crucial reminders as to what it means to be human in the best and deepest sense of the word. For the theology that later came to be attached to this birth story held that this baby who was born in the midst of rather dangerous and very precarious circumstances also, quote, God. I don't know what that statement means in any literal sense of the term, since I don't have a literal concept of a being or an entity called God. But as we are reminded by the aforementioned mythologist, late Joseph Campbell, that we should not get caught in the literalness of a metaphor, not get caught in the terminology. With that in mind, let me offer a couple of ways in which I find the myth of the God-child to be helpful and instructive. The first is that the story or myth of an obscure baby, who is also heralded as the arrival of God, is a human reminder that what is often overlooked, or ignored, or unseen, or cast aside, can also be of greatest importance. It's a reminder that even those, perhaps especially those, who were born and live under the most precarious of circumstances, that these people too are equally deserving of their chance to realize the inherent worth and dignity that they do possess. To be sure, at some point, when the child is no longer a child, what he or she does with such an opportunity is a matter of personal choice and personal responsibility. But if that divine spark, to use Emerson's term, that we all carry within us, if that's not affirmed and validated at an early age, it becomes harder and harder to realize as time goes by. I think the image of a child born under very precarious circumstances who also embodies the divine is a reminder of that truth. Second piece of insight I gained from the myth of an anticipated child through whom God arrives is really one about an affirmation power and potentiality of human life itself. I find it very instructive that, at the heart of Christian theology is the affirmation of a God who arrives not as a supernatural force or power, but instead, quite simply, as a humble human being who devotes his life and eventually loses his life while teaching other human beings how to be more human. Some Christians have caught this point very well, while others have not. I think one of the reasons I find myself attracted to the works of such liberal Christian theologians as Marcus Borg or John Shelby Sponge, for a couple of examples, is because they really do get it with this kind of interpretation. Well, be that as it may, the God-child metaphor also suggests to me, as a religious humanist, that all I need when it comes to finding meaning, depth, power, and relatedness in my life has already been given to me, because I'm a human being too. I may not, in fact, I know I haven't opened up a whole package of possibility for myself, even at this point in my life. And I may never do so fully during my time on earth. But it has been given to me. So the metaphor of a child who embodies God is a way of saying that Godot actually does arrive, but not, in Schuller's words again, as a cosmic sugar daddy, but as a fellow traveler who reminds us and encourages us with the understanding that we already have what we need for the journey if we dare to use it, and that we can indeed be up and on our way. In addition, the story or myth or metaphor of a newborn child who also embodies the divine recalls yet another of Dr. Campbell's words to Bill Moyers in their public broadcasting sponsored dialogues a number of years ago, where Campbell says, "All the gods, all the heavens, all the worlds are within you." And so I'm grateful to Samuel Beckett for reminding me in his best-known play of the futility of passively and powerlessly waiting for someone or something to come and deliver me. And I am grateful as well for the mythology of the Gospels, which I'll revisit in a couple of weeks, because the freedom with which I read them allows me to see that I don't have to wait for what I need. Don't have to wait for Godot, as it were, since the fullness of life and living is already available right here. Here on what the poet Edwin Markham calls the common human way. And finally, I come into this season with a sense of, as the sermon title indicates, expectations lost and gained. It's easy to be cynical, if not despairing, about the promise of the arrival of a reign of peace and love and hope and joy, the four themes that Christian Advent proclaims. It's easy to despair of ever seeing the arrival of the full realization or manifestation of justice, equity, and compassion in human relations that we affirm and promote, or of our reaching the level of respect for the interdependent web of life that will actually give us a safe and protected planet to live on. I know it's easy to lose any sense of expectation that these things will ever come to be. I also know that sitting beside a road, so to speak, awaiting the arrival of these great and wonderful things will not bring them into being, not even in any small or measured way. Whatever there is to be gained, when it comes to all these hopes and expectations, is that their arrival, to whatever extent that arrival is to happen, remains in our hands, remains in our hearts. The story or myth of a God who shows up as a simple human being in quite desperate circumstances is a reminder to me of that truth. The arrival of all that we want remains in our hands and in our hearts. So let us take these two stories to heart then, as we enter this holiday season of holy days, let us be up and on our way, believing in all that we may still bring to pass. With that in mind, let's sing together our closing hymn. It's number 226, People Looking.